Thank you all for attending session 224, which is titled God as an Answer to Fermi's Paradox. This session is being recorded and audio will be available for purchase at the Sunstone Audio Desk after the session. So a little bit about this session. In 1950, at a lunch in Los Alamos, Enrico Fermi asked his famous question, "Where are they?" The they in question were intelligent extraterrestrials, for which there was no evidence then or now. But what if people are imagining extraterrestrial contact all wrong? What if God is an extraterrestrial? This idea will not seem so outlandish to Mormons, and once you accept it, many mysteries are resolved. For example, any extraterrestrial civilization would be inconceivably advanced, making them potentially far more interested in the morality of our choices than the shininess of our gadgets. Ross Ritchie, the presenter, is a software entrepreneur living in Salt Lake City. In his spare time, he maintains a blog/podcast at jeremiah820.blogspot.com, where he posts weekly on the intersection between religion and technology. So we'll turn it over to Ross.
Thanks. Should I smile? Okay. How many here would say you're already really familiar with Fermi's paradox? Oh, okay. Well, so that's good. Because I figured that people would only show up to this presentation if they already knew what Fermi's paradox was, and then, you know, I wasn't sure how much to explain. Anyway, whatever. And in fact, I really thought that if I wanted people to show up for sure, that what I really should have labeled it is Death Stars, Ray Guns, Space Empires, and Our Future Alien Overlords, the true story of Joseph Smith's science fiction vision of the galaxy. Maybe next year I'll submit one like that. And it may be, I don't know. I don't know that I'm actually going to cover all those topics, so maybe that would have been false advertising to label it that way. But anyway, so I'll give you a little background on Fermi's paradox. So as you kind of heard in the intro she gave, in 1950, Enrico Fermi, one of the great scientists of the nuclear age, helped with the atomic bomb. He's hanging out at Los Alamos, and they go to lunch, right? And some of you may remember the 50s. Certainly I don't, but anyway, there was a big UFO craze, right? And over lunch, they're talking about UFOs, they're talking about spaceships, they're wondering, you know, what is going on here? And as they're talking through various things, Fermi suddenly kind of blurts out, like, well, where are they, right? Now, Fermi was actually famous for coming up with these things called Fermi approximations, where he would kind of take numbers you could know and derive numbers you couldn't know. One of the most famous Fermi's approximations was the number of piano tuners in Chicago, right? And anyway, but so he goes back to his office and he starts running the numbers, right? And he looks at the number of stars and he looks at, you know, how long things have been around. And essentially, he comes up with this answer that really we should have been visited long ago and many times over, right? So that's the paradox, is why haven't we done that? Why, despite, you know, all this stuff, why haven't we? And it has, I mean, I don't know, there it has captured some segment of the popular imagination. And but it also is, to the best of my knowledge, the only question asked over lunch, which became, you know, sort of a philosophical question, right? So the big thing that baffles Fermi is just how many potential places there are for life to form, right? I don't know if you've seen this before. This is the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, right? So they take a tiny segment of space that looks absolutely dark, and they focus the Hubble on it for however long it takes to get the exposure they want. And basically, all these little dots are galaxies, right? And each galaxy, their best estimate has between, you know, about 100 billion stars. So the number of potential places where life could develop, considering that, you know, recently, if you've been following the Kepler Space Telescope, it turns out just about every star has a planet. So you're looking at a lot of places for life to develop. So just to give you an idea of how small this image is, it would take 12 million images of this size to capture the entire night sky, right? So take however many galaxies are in there, 1,000, right? Times that by 12 million, right? I mean, essentially, the math I looked up on the online is that there's 123 quintillion stars in the visible universe, right? So we're already into numbers. As I said, Fermi ran some numbers, but he wasn't the first to do it. There's actually the Drake equation. Anybody heard of the Drake equation? Okay. Same kind of thing, right? The Drake decided he was actually having a meeting to sort of kick off the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and he decided to come. He kind of, in an hour, he sat down and he came up with this equation. So essentially, and I think I may have even talked to some of you about this yesterday after my previous presentation, essentially Drake's equation acts as a series of filters. And as it turns out, filter is very important when it comes to Fermi's paradox, because there is some filter which is keeping intelligent life from developing, and either it's behind us or ahead of us, and that's one of the big questions. But anyway, Drake's equation acts as a series of filters. So the first one is the number of stars. As we said, that's 123 quintillion, but of course we're probably only interested in stars in our Milky Way, which is closer to... I read a figure that it was 250 billion plus or minus 150 billion, which is a pretty big error bar, actually. But anyway, so then you take the number of stars with planets. So you take the, let's say, 250 billion stars, you multiply that by the percentage of stars that have planets, which is actually, as best as we know, about 100%. Then you take the percentage of those that have life, and from there you filter out any place where there is life, but it's not intelligent. And finally, you times it by the percentage that are intelligent life, but they're actually capable of interstellar communication, right? Now, after you do all that, you end up with the number of detectable civilizations in our galaxy, right? So far, as far as we can tell, that number is zero, right? But one of the big things to recognize is that once you move past number of stars and percentage of stars with planets, basically everything else we're just kind of guessing, right? Everything else, people have good guesses, they do their best, but really these are, the numbers here are all over the place, right? So, but what both Drake and Fermi realize is that the top number is so big, right, that really there should be something out there, right? So as I said, there's a lot of guesswork. Well, let's just review some of the things that make alien life more likely and some of the things that make it less likely. So on the list of things that make it more likely, first off, in addition to the immense number of stars, is the immense age of the universe, right? The opportunity, the time for an intelligent civilization to develop is billions and billions of years. Now, even if it used to be that we assumed that, well, oh, you need rocky planets, right? You need something that kind of looks like Earth before alien life can develop, right? And they figured that maybe Earth was kind of near the beginning, and so maybe we're all kind of near the beginning. But as Kepler got into action, as they looked at things, they found that there are rocky planets as early as 2 billion years after the Big Bang, right? Which puts them 6 billion years ahead of us, right? So there has been a lot of time for civilization, life to develop, and a lot of time for, if it has developed, for them to, you know, to spread out, right? Another factor is panspermia. Does anybody know what panspermia is? Yeah, okay. So panspermia is the idea that life bearing, either life or, life-bearing elements or actual life can travel between planets. Like life from Earth could travel to Mars, possibly after being ejected by an impact. And it turns out that this is actually more common than people think. Not the life part. We don't know how common it is for life to travel between planets. But when the asteroid or the comet crashed into Earth that destroyed the dinosaurs, actually about 100 tons of Earth material ended up at a planet in a nearby star system, right? Now, was there life on there? Who knows, right? I mean, it's hard to say, but there's actually quite a bit of that. So, is it happening? Who knows? Does it make the existence of life a little more common, a little more probable? It does, right? Next, turns out that recently we've discovered that life is a lot tougher than we thought. right? It used to be that we thought, well, there's this very narrow band where life can exist, but then we find life in volcanic vents. We find it at the bottom of the ocean under incredible pressures. We find it in high salinity environments. We find there's all these examples of what are called extremophiles that can exist kind of anywhere. And interestingly enough, just yesterday, after I got home from Sunstone, I was kind of on the web, and I saw an article. I don't vouch for it. It was just an article that said that they had found worms in the Siberian permafrost, and that they, after being frozen for 42,000 years, when they warmed up, those worms came back to life, right? So that seems pretty incredible. The next one is communication at the speed of light. It may take a while to travel between planets. I mean, that's a lot of people's objection when you talk about that's one of the big objections, which we'll get to this idea of why haven't we encountered alien life, is that, well, it's space is really big, but you can at least communicate at the speed of light, which is not, it still takes 4 years to get to Alpha Centauri, but that's not ridiculous, right? Finally, there's the idea of self-replicating probes. Sometimes they're called von Neumann probes. This is the idea that you take something that can make copies of itself. You take a probe, you send it to a nearby planet. Yeah, there's only one probe, but it has within it, 3D printers, it has, extra, CPUs or whatever, and it lands on that planet, takes the raw materials, uses whatever, creates copies of itself, and it just kind of infinitely expands and spreads across the galaxy. And under those circumstances, you could be everywhere from a galactic standpoint, from the time scale of the universe, fairly quickly, right? And I think most people would agree we're not that far away from being able to do this. And finally, there's the mediocrity principle, right? All previous times when we thought we were special, when we thought Earth was unique, when we thought intelligent life was unique, right? Now, it turns out, in all previous cases where something like this, that we were wrong. Right? When we thought we were at the center of the solar system, we were wrong. When we thought we were at the center of the universe, we were wrong. When we thought that humans were special, then Darwin came along, right? I mean, every time we thought there was something especially unique about humanity, it turns out we were wrong. So, seems like maybe the way to bet is, like, this time we're going to be wrong, too. So, anyway, in which case, if we are average, if the Earth is an average planet, then there should be lots of others like us. Okay, so that's the stuff that make it more likely. On the stuff that makes it less likely, we do have, as I already kind of alluded to, the idea that space is pretty big. My favorite quote on this subject is from Douglas Adams in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He said, "Space is big, really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the road to the chemist, but that's just peanuts to space." Anyway, so obviously, the vast distances make it less likely. Then there's kind of a broad category of things that might make Earth rare, right? Like maybe it turns out that the transition from single-celled life to multicellular life is really difficult, right? Or maybe we have some enormous luck in having Mars to gestate life and then transfer it to Earth, and Jupiter to protect us from all the asteroids, and maybe we're just exceptionally lucky, right? But this, of course, when we talk about the filters, this all relates to filters that are behind this. That there was something about Earth that led to life and intelligent life that actually is extremely rare, right? But nobody knows what those might be, and so there's just a lot of guess. The next is, filters that might be in front of us. Kind of almost anything else you can think of, right? I mean, I've heard explanations from, as technology gets advanced enough, virtual reality gets so good that we ignore normal reality, we ignore the kind of things like, space exploration or industry or whatever, and we spend all our time playing World of Warcraft, I guess, right? So that is one explanation. So, I mean, just about anything you can think of has been proposed for as an explanation for a filter that may lie in front of us. Of course, one of the most popular ones is, we'll blow ourselves up with nukes, right? That intelligent species end up blowing themselves up with nuclear weapons long before they manage to make it to the next planet. But because, given that everything, once again, everything other than the first one is just wild speculation, when someone says, oh, well, we figured out the Fermi's paradox, I always urge, you know, a little bit of caution there, right? So the problem, and the problem with a lot of times when we discuss Fermi's paradox, is that people have certain expectations, certain preconceptions, and I'm going to spend a fair amount of the presentation talking about these preconceptions. I mean, one of them is that they kind of, when people imagine, you know, aliens and visitations by aliens, this is kind of what they imagine, right? This is kind of the default. And you know, I mean, maybe it's not exactly this, but there's lots of preconceptions. And one of my pet peeves, I guess, one of the big ones, is the idea that that the aliens are going to suddenly show up in the near future, right? Now, let's think about this for a second, right? Well, I already said that, you know, Earth-like rocky planets existed 6 billion years before Earth, right? So let's imagine that, conceivably, there is a galactic civilization that's 6 billion years ahead of us, right? But let's be conservative and imagine they're only like 1 billion years ahead of us. To put it another way, they could have shown up any time in the last billion years, right? They could have decided whatever they wanted to do with Earth, they could have decided to do it any time in the last billion years. So for them to randomly show up in the next 100 is a 1 in 10 million chance, right? Not quite as bad as the lottery, but not great odds, right? The point is that if there are civilizations out there, my contention is they're either already aware of us or they never will be, or certainly they never will be within the lifespan of everyone sitting here, right? Like, because if you're looking at the possible lifespans of you know, conceivable extraterrestrial civilization, you're talking about millions and millions of years, right? And so the chances of anything happening one way or the other in the next 50 is pretty small. The next thing they talk about is that when they do show up, there's going to be a lot of them, right? You know, it's like, it's kind of, I hesitate to do this because it's such a bad, well, I mean, it's an okay movie. It's an okay popcorn movie. But, you know, they'll show up and they'll blow up the White House and there'll be saucers everywhere and it'll be this, you know, giant, huge thing. We won't have any indication of aliens and then all of a sudden they'll be here, right? Or, you know, they'll land on the world and try and teach us their strange language, right? The arrival thing. I don't know how many have seen these movies. I'm going to reference them a little bit later just because they're kind of interesting touchstones. But as we pointed out, based on the limitations of extraterrestrial travel, it's a million times easier for them to communicate with us first, right? And so if they are, so there is a good chance, I think, that there won't be many of them based on the how difficult it is to travel, and they'll probably start with communication. And then, of course, there's the favorite trope of science fiction, that they'll have technology that's better than us, but only just a little bit. And that when you add our scrappiness to our technology level, we can beat them, right? You know? but in reality, if a civilization could be 6 billion years ahead of us, 1 billion years ahead of us, it doesn't matter. I mean, 1 million years ahead of us, 1,000 years ahead of us. I mean, imagine a civilization showed up that was 1,000 years ahead of us. We may not recognize their technology even if it was 1,000 years, and it's much more likely to be way, way bigger than that, right? And then, of course, everybody assumes that they, you know, when they do show up, they'll mostly be interested in blowing us up or studying us or, you know, bringing us into the UFOs. Did I go way past? Okay, I did click a bit. Okay, but so I'm saying, based on the arguments, what we should really expect aliens to be like is already aware of us, if they're ever going to be, mostly focused on communication and godlike in power. And I love this Clark's Third Law. That's Arthur C. Clarke. I don't know if you can read his shirt. It says, I invented the satellite and all I got was this lousy T-shirt. So I think technically he invented the geosynchronous satellite, not the satellite period, but maybe I'm wrong. So he said any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. In this setting, I like to change it to indistinguishable from a miracle, right? Like how, I mean, it's pure preconception to assume that something that we assume is divine and miraculous couldn't be alien technology, right? So, yeah. So, and then to go back a little bit, I was looking at my notes. It should be pointed out, Interstellar Conquest doesn't make a lot of sense, and also it doesn't make a lot of sense in the narrow time frame I talked about, right? Like, if the aliens from Independence Day had really wanted to take over the Earth, if most of these civilizations have been around for millions of years, then they could have done it at any point in that time, right? Like, they chose exactly the wrong time to do it, right? Like, if the aliens were going to show up and take us on, showing up right now is the wrong time to do it. They should have showed up at least 25 years earlier when the MacBook didn't exist, right? So the point is, if an alien is after, wiping out life or harvesting Earth for resources, then the assumption should be that if there are aliens out there and they're interested in conquest or interested in wiping out life, that they probably should have already done it, right? That it's unlikely, if they haven't already done it, that they're going to do it. Anyway, so moving on. Okay. So, and I did have a fourth faulty assumption, that whole conquest thing. And so here are the things I think they definitely wouldn't want, based on all this, right? I don't think they'd want our help, right? I mean, we're assuming they're godlike in power. There's probably not a lot that we could do to help them. However, much the movies say, I don't know if you saw a million years ago, that movie, The Last Navigator or whatever, where they show up and they steal the kid, Flight of the Navigator, show up and steal the kid and they make him navigate. I don't think they're really going to want our help. I don't think they're going to want our resources. I mean, first off, transporting resources across interstellar distances is not a great way to go about it. And secondly, I assume if they'd have the tech, they don't. They probably don't need raw materials. They aren't going to need our technology. And as I said, if there was some drive to exterminate other life because of the competition aspect, I think they already would have done it, right? So. Yeah, maybe. I mean, there's lots of possibilities, lots of edge cases, but I think when you look at, what's most likely to happen, I think they're mostly not gonna need a new home or anything. I think these are things they might actually be interested in, right? They might be interested in giving us help. They might be interested in sharing their technology or preventing our extermination, right? I mean, if they already have all the tech, if they are a million years ahead of us, right, then there's probably not much they want from them, but there's probably a lot they could give. They could give to us. Now, this sharing technology is interesting because lots of times when you're talking about science fiction or Fermi's paradox or what have you, right? There's this idea. Okay, well, we're going to end up sharing their technology, or we're going to end up figuring out their technology, or we're going to end up, doing whatever, right? Well, the thing is that based on the technology we already have and how dangerous that is, it's unlikely they're just going to want to share technology with us right off the bat, particularly if they want to prevent our extermination at the same time, right? There's no way they're going to give us, black hole torpedoes or the technology for black hole torpedoes unless they're sure we can handle it. And so my argument is, and one of the crux of the argument, is that they are going to be interested in our morals and characters, that despite, what most people think, that they're mostly interested in kidnapping us and putting us into their spaceships and probing us in weird ways or, showing up and blowing us up, I think they are going to be interested in how mature we are as a civilization, right? Like, can we handle, before they share technology or do anything like that, really they're going to be worried about, can we handle that, right? Can we handle the technology they're going to give us, right? So, this leaves us with two possibilities, right? Possibility number one, there are no aliens or extraterrestrials. We're alone in a vast, uncaring universe, adrift in time and space, and there's nobody to help us but us, right? Prepare to embrace nihilism, as I say, right? This is what it looks like, right? Empty, lonely, and nothing is forever. The other possibility is that there are aliens, and my argument is if so, they're most likely already aware of us, or already here, so to speak. They're mostly interested in communication. They're concerned about our morality, right? And also, they would appear to us as gods, right? And hopefully, they're working to keep us from exterminating ourselves. Because if they don't care about exterminating ourselves, then I don't think that they're, you know, they're going to be interested in much else that, that goes on. So at this point, I've probably drawn out things long enough. I think you know where I'm going, right? The point is that this list of descriptors sounds an awful lot like God, as typically envisioned by, you know, Christian people, right? Now, I don't know enough about other religions to speak confidently about those, but essentially, something that's already here, already communicating with us, you know, actual visits are fairly limited and talked about for a long time, concerned about immorality. Not, you know, they don't come and give us an X-ray gun. They really want to know, like, you know, can we handle certain responsibilities? Can we handle the responsibilities of creation, right? Like, it does seem odd that aliens would be interested in, you know, where and with whom we have sex, but that is one of the things that, you know, okay, you've got this massive responsibility of creating new life. If we give you godlike powers, you're going to be able to do way more creative things than that, create planets, create whatever. Like, we kind of want to know what you can do with the powers you already have. And then these, and godlike powers, well, God does, by definition, have godlike powers, right? So, but, you know, obviously this is silly. Who would conflate religion and aliens, right? Well, maybe us, right? The Book of Abraham, Kolob, I guess Mormons actually do conflate God with aliens, right, on some level. Now, you can get pretty deep in the woods if you start talking about Kolob, and I'm already probably, you know, pretty far out there, I guess, so I'm not going to try and go any farther, but as we read in Abraham, there is, it talks about there's one planet above another, and Uniah and Kolob, right, and I don't know that this makes, you know, a huge amount of sense in terms of, you know, you should look here using the Hubble telescope kind of thing, but it is something where right from the very beginning of the religion, we essentially said God is an alien. We don't, you know, don't get up in the next fast and testimony meeting or whatever and say that, right? But I think that's essentially what we believe. There's even a song about it, you know. I'm not going to ask anybody to sing it, what's interesting is that a noted atheist, has anybody here heard of Michael Shermer? Yeah. It's actually interesting. He said basically the same thing, although he didn't take it to the next step, and as far as I know, he's still an atheist. But he said, is God nothing more than a sufficiently advanced extraterrestrial intelligence? So, I would argue that the Mormon answer to Fermi's paradox is, where are they, is that they're here already and have existed for as long as we have recorded history, which is what you would expect, right? Like if a godlike extraterrestrial civilization had been around for millions of years and they've either found us and decided what to do with us or they haven't, right? We call them God, call him God, however you call her God. I know this is Sunstone. Call them, call Z God, I don't know. Anyway, and we call our communication with them prayer, right? Now, to the best of my knowledge, I'm the only person who suggested this in exactly this fashion. Now, if someone is familiar with someone else who's done this, I would love to know. I have looked, I've gone around, but I've not seen this exact thing proposed. Well, yes, but not quite to the level of detail, right? And you didn't call it Fermi's paradox, right? Touche, I guess. But so, as I talk, I feel like the reason that this hasn't been proposed, I mean, it's entirely possible the reason it hasn't been proposed is it's a dumb idea and it's crazy, right? Like, I can admit that, right? But I also think the reason it hasn't been proposed is that there are an enormous number of preconceptions when people think about aliens and space travel and stuff like that. And I think the biggest preconception of all is that you've got religion on one side and you've got science fiction on the other side. And they have nothing to do with one another, right? That these are not the same thing at all, right? That whatever religion has to say can never have an impact on what we're trying to do with our science or futurism or predicting what's going to happen. And then whatever science fiction does, you know, or whatever we think is going to happen, it has nothing to do with religion. So, so I think that without these preconceptions, I think more people would at least toss this as a theory. I mean, there are I have a book at home that has 75 explanations for Fermi's paradox, and it turns out this is not one of them, right? I've emailed the author, and he's like, I never considered that. That's very interesting, right? And so I think that if there were those preconceptions, this would be among at least one of the possible explanations, right? I mean, even if it's not the explanation, which, I mean, I kind of think it is, but even if it wasn't, at least it would be considered. So, I mean, let's go through these a list of the preconceptions. I mean, we've already talked about them, but let's, you know, kind of assemble them all in one place. The first is, like I said, that religion and science fiction, futurism, they have nothing to do with one another. There's no overlap, right? Second, the preconception that aliens could show up any day now, and most likely to show up soon. I mean, when was the last time you saw a movie, you know, involving aliens where they didn't, like, it didn't involve that first contact, right? Like, everybody imagines, like, oh, well, somehow in the next 100 years we'll find aliens. Well, I mean, either they already know we're here, or they're never going to know. That is my big pet peeve, as I said. There's the other, that there's a good chance that when they do show up, that they'll want to destroy us. Has anybody, just as a tangent, anybody here read The Three-Body Problem? Okay, you should. Good, great science fiction novel by a Chinese author. It was translated into to English. Essentially, the whole point of that series is that any aliens which find out that we exist immediately destroy you because of they don't want to handle the competition. And there are people that believe that. There are people who believe that we shouldn't ever broadcast out in an attempt to contact aliens because, you know, we're essentially like Native Americans, you know, trying to get Columbus to come, is what they argue. I mean, yeah. Stephen Hawking was another one who basically said something along those lines. And it's funny because I referenced Stephen Hawking in my last presentation, but not this one. So, and all these three, you might call the Independence Day view of aliens, right? Aliens are out there, they're big and bad, they're going to suddenly show up and they're going to destroy us, right? Unless we have Jeff Goldblum.
That's true.
Another preconception is, you know, people try and free their mind, like, well, we don't have any idea what aliens are going to be like. And so they kind of ignore, well, there are some examples of how humanity has dealt in a similar situation, but they kind of ignore those. And I'm going to get into those a bit. That when aliens do show up, they are going to be alien, right? They're going to be weird, they're going to have 7 legs, they're going to have a strange language and materials we don't understand, and it's going to be, you know, this weird, incredibly difficult thing to contact them. Or I guess technically there's a Star Trek version where they all look like humans in bad makeup, right? But and this is kind of, here we're getting kind of into the Arrival view of aliens, right? Now, how many have seen the movie Arrival? Okay, so we got a few. So this is the idea that, they're going to show up. They're going to be weird, but not too weird. And then also that whatever alien communication looks like, it won't look like prayer. Like, no, I'm pretty sure that this is the one thing that no one, maybe other than me, has said, well, prayer is alien communication, and thus answers Fermi paradox. Because that just seems way too weird, right? That would be anything along those lines, right? And finally, and this is a whole topic unto itself, and maybe I shouldn't have even added it to the list, but it's another kind of pet peeve of mine, that you can explain the uniqueness of the Earth by the anthropic principle. Has anybody heard of the anthropic principle? Yeah. So essentially, the idea that this is a quote that kind of explains it. Conscious life will only be found in places where conditions allow it to exist. Therefore, when we look around and find that things are set up just the right way for us to exist, it couldn't be any other way, because if they weren't set up in just the right way, no one would be around to do the looking. I kind of feel like this is tautological, this argument, but I mean, it's a whole topic unto itself, right? So, anyway, we kind of mostly covered sort of the Independence Day view of aliens, and now we're kind of going to look at the Arrival view of aliens. Hopefully, if you haven't seen Arrival, aliens show up and they need to teach humans their language for reasons which are later to be revealed, right? But let's start by looking at our own experience. We do have an experience with contacting new intelligent life that we've never contacted before, right? In the more recent times, we call these people uncontacted tribes. Now, in the past, there was when the Europeans discovered the New World, back in the bad old days or good old days, I guess, depending on your perspective, what was the very first thing that we would do when we found a new people?
Take their wealth, give them our diseases.
Okay. Just after that. No. No, I mean, one of the very first things we did was we would send Christian missionaries, right? Now, maybe those Christian missionaries stole all their wealth and then gave them all the diseases, right? I mean, maybe that was the vector for the wealth stealing and the disease giving. I'm not going to necessarily get into an argument about that, right? But there was a time when the very first thing we thought to do when we found somebody new was like, oh, we need to teach them religion, right? We need to give them our morality, right? Now, imagine that you felt like you had the perfect religion, right? If you were confident you could give them religion, you're confident you wouldn't steal all their wealth and give all their diseases. That might still be something aliens are interested in doing, right? As I said, they can't give us our technology without being sure that we know how to use it, so they might give us their religion first. So the point I'm trying to make is that the idea that aliens are interested in religion, maybe not insane, right? But now, what do we do? Well, we don't give them technology. We don't drop guns or anything else. In fact, we don't even give them much. I mean, right now, uncontacted tribes, they're uncontacted for a reason. We just leave them alone, right? Now, I mean, that's another explanation for Fermi's paradox called the zoo hypothesis. But if you look at what God does, he does mostly leave us alone. Certainly when you look at what people wish God would do, he definitely leaves us alone, right? And so, so for most people, what God does is he says you can pray to me, right? And we'll get to that in a second. Next, there's this idea that aliens will look aliens, okay? So we just talked about uncontacted tribes. Imagine the very best way of contacting an uncontacted tribe, right? Imagine further that you have any technology you can imagine, right? That you can perform miracles with this technology, right? How would you, if you had to, and you had all the tech in the world, and you could do anything you want with it, how would you contact an uncontacted tribe? Wouldn't you show up looking exactly like them, speaking their language? I mean, wouldn't you be almost indistinguishable, right? Like, the idea that aliens are going to show up looking like aliens, assuming they have godlike technology, assuming all these things, doesn't seem to make any sense, right? Like, if you really wanted to show up and talk to humans, wouldn't you give them a method they could easily use, talk to them in their language, you know? I mean, if you're going to come down, wouldn't you look exactly like them, right? Now, not to say that, I mean, you know, Jesus was taking a form he was unaccustomed to in the sacred grove. I don't want to get into that, right? But I mean, the point is that in some respects, people reject the idea, you know, if they ever consider the idea of God as an extraterrestrial, they would represent it because he looks too human. But if you really had miraculous technology, all the technology you want, that is precisely how you do it. At least that's my argument. Finally, we'll get to prayer. And this is a little bit speculative. Also, this is the time in the presentation where I either talk really fast or try to stretch things out. And it looks like actually I'm doing pretty good. I wanted to leave about 15 minutes for questions, so I think that's about where we're at. Anyway, but once again, getting back to uncontacted tribes. You're an anthropologist, right? You have miraculous technology. Let's imagine you had access to prayer. That would be pretty freaking cool, right? Like, you were trying to figure out what's going on with this uncontacted tribe or going on with this civilization. You have direct access to their inner thoughts. They tell you exactly what's going on, their hopes, their fears, whatever. There's no violence attached. You're not showing up. If you could have somebody just, like, think to you and you understood their language and you could occasionally, you know, communicate back, you'd be like, You'd be loving life, right, as an anthropologist. So, I think that, as I said, people still view this as pretty silly, but as I also said, I wasn't able to find anybody who was, you know, making this argument, and certainly I wasn't finding anybody who was debating against this argument, so I can only kind of imagine the objections people might have, but let's go through a few that I imagine they might have. Objection one, prayer is scientifically impossible. Like, you can't do that. Like, it'd be nice, sure, if you were an anthropologist and you could get right into someone's inner life, it would be nice, but in reality, it's scientifically impossible. Well, I hope that this wouldn't be an argument, right? Because, I mean, when we think about, when you imagine what technology would be like if we had a million more years, it's hard to say what, you know, what we could or couldn't do, right? If we just had a million more years to work on technology. And like Arthur C. Clarke said, I mean, I think any sufficiently advanced technology would be indistinguishable from magic or in the case I like, a miracle, right? So I mean, there's all sorts of things which we thought were impossible. Maybe prayer is one of the fundamental laws of physics that you can never do, but imagine given a million years what you could or couldn't do. So I just don't give much credence to that objection. Second, prayer is not the way aliens would contact us. Well, I mean, this is one again. Once again, people have a preconception about what aliens would or wouldn't do, and I think if you toss out your preconceptions, that this is actually not a bad way of contacting us, right? Like this is a way where you're not creating a worldwide panic. You're not creating anything. You're talking one person to another. You can detect the morality or the hopes and fears of one individual, person by person. I mean, if you are going to contact someone, how much better to contact people on an individual basis than to have to, you know, broadcast a message to the entire world, right? And also, one of the things that I think overshadows everything is a quote by Mark Twain. It's not what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's the things you think you know that aren't true that get you in trouble, right? So what you know for sure that ain't so. And I think there's a lot of things that when it comes to what we think we know about, you know, how space works and whatever, there's a lot of things we're really sure we know, and I'm not sure that's the case. Finally, the prayer is inexplicably selective, right? Like, you know, I think that non-Mormons might wonder why extraterrestrials would select 15 men to receive the best communication at all, if that's what you believe, you know. And that does seem, yes, inexplicably selective. But getting back to, you know, uncontacted tribes and stuff like that, well, you probably wouldn't contact them all at once. You'd probably work one at a time, right? And you might start with a gradual program where you're contacting a few people, seeing how that goes, and contacting more, sort of a pilot program, so to speak, right? But anyway, so this is just some wildly speculative stuff. My point is not that prayer is so obviously alien communication as to preclude any other possible explanation or anything else going on, or that Fermi's paradox is obviously proof of God. But given how little we know about this subject and how little we know about how things would work, I'm arguing that it fits at least as well as any other explanation, and in some ways, even better. And I always end my presentations with an XKCD comic. This one says, "The Fermi paradox. Planets are so common that life should be too. So where is it? Well, now we know. It's not that life inevitably destroys itself with war. It's just that it takes longer to develop space colonization than it does to invent an activity more fun than survival." And then it shows the guy paragliding with the wingsuit. You've seen those? And the guy, "Holy crap!" And the other guy, "I don't care how dangerous it is, I have to try it." This is one explanation of Fermi's paradox, not a very well-known one, but the idea that we come up with some kind of tech which precludes space colonization. So anyway, I think that's about it. There's time for questions. Here's my contact info if anybody is even remotely interested, and thanks for your attention. And now if there are any questions, I'm available. And I think they want you to come to the mic.
I absolutely loved your presentation. Science fiction has been a big interest of mine, and lately Mormonism has also been an interest, so
okay.
There's absolute intersection. I would point you to Elna Baker's This American Life episode.
On Fermi's Paradox?
Well, what she talks about is a movie where it's an alien encounter in Arizona. Fire in the Sky.
Oh, okay.
And she compares her faith in Mormonism to trying to explain her belief in Mormonism, that, you know, that it's just some intangible reason why she believes.
And was this American Life?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought I'd listened to all of them, at least recently, but I guess not.
So the thread that runs through it again is like through contact. You know, you have in Carl Sagan's book Contact.
Oh, yeah.
He says, why isn't God leaving some evidence for us to find? So, you know.
Right.
The thing that I would point out is that I'm a big fan of Star Trek. Obviously, the first generation and especially the next generation.
Okay.
There's an episode with Captain Picard where he's injected into a primitive civilization. And as the case usually comes around, that he has to, you know, use the transporter. He's seen by the primitive civilization. And obviously, the trend is that they were going to create a new religion. And so
right.
Picard is not down for being worshipped as a god.
Right.
And anyway, I would point you to that kind of science fiction. I absolutely loved your lecture. It's right there with, the fiction of Clark. The thing that I would say about Mormonism in conclusion, just as a comment, that I think if Smith had not gone in the direction of creating a religion and just written science fiction, he would be a lot more well received than he is. You know, he predates Jules Verne.
Sure. So. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Just a comment. Well, you can get the next question, but I found the book Contact very interesting because if you remember the book Contact by Carl Sagan, he has this spot where they're on a TV show and there's an atheist and he's totally talking about how smart he is and he shuts people down. But when she actually gets to the point of communicating with the aliens, they say, oh, by the way, there's a code embedded in Pi, right, from previous aliens. Like, if you can embed a code in Pi, you're a god, right? God exists and he embedded a code in Pi, right? He may be a different god than what we expect, but it's a god, right? You believe in God. If something you can embed, you know. So it was really interesting that Carl Sagan went a long ways to kind of push atheism, and then he essentially created a god, right? Anyway, sorry, next question.
Yes, my question has to do with the possibility judging from legitimate, scholarly, credible people in several nations, that government officials, former astronauts, astrophysicists, politicians, some insist that the U.S. government has information and knowledge about alien contact. For example, Bill Clinton said
right.
he wanted to know about it. Is it possible that that's true, and even presidents, when they come into office, are kept from this knowledge? And if so, who could keep a secret like that?
Right. Well, I mean, obviously, you can't absolutely say that's totally impossible, right? You can't say that something has a 0% possibility. But I would rate the probability of that as fairly low. First off, as you point out, like most of these times when you have conspiracy theories like that, it requires the secrecy of vast numbers of people, which decreases the probability. So I personally wouldn't put much weight behind that, but it is interesting, you know.
I was wondering if you had heard anything. The famous atheist Richard Dawkins he's famously mocked Mormonism. But in another interview, he also talked about the idea that if there is a God, God would have to be an extraterrestrial that had evolved by sort of natural means. And I remember hearing that interview and going, "Wow, if he understood, I think, Mormonism in the way that I understand it, he would almost be defending."
Right.
So I don't know how you would react.
Yeah. No. I actually. As I said, I've got a blog, and I've written a lot about Fermi's paradox, one or the other, and I actually came across that Dawkins quote, and I wrote about it somewhere, now that you remind me of it, but it didn't make it in the presentation. But yeah, he said, as I recall, you know, there could be a God out there, and aliens would have God-like powers, but the only difference is that the only difference between this God and the normal God we think about is that he would have come up via the process of natural selection, right? And it's like, oh, well, if you could find a religion that believed that, then maybe, you know, so it is interesting. And also Michael Shermer, same thing, right? These are devout atheists. I mean, they are hardcore, you know, throw down, take no prisoners atheists, and yet they kind of both realize, oh, well, there is this way that it can happen. And I think that it's interesting that no one seems to kind of take the next step, you know. Any other questions? Yeah.
So prayer has always been a big obstacle for me, believing in the intersection between technology and Mormonism. But it seems kind of what you're describing is kind of a zoo theory, but not just like a normal zoo theory. It's like an incredibly curated zoo theory where, like, in a normal zoo, people aren't going in and trying to distinguish the thoughts of the animals.
Sure, yeah.
And then it's an invisible zoo as well, that like the animals aren't aware that they're even in. So my question in your theory is why? What is the purpose of these extraterrestrials? What is the purpose of them being here so close to the Earth and being so involved and so curated? And why are they doing it in such an invisible manner that most people in science can't even detected? I'm just wondering, what would their purpose be?
Sure, sure. So it's too bad you weren't at my presentation yesterday, because that's kind of that side of things. So, I mean, just really briefly, yesterday I talked about how AI researchers are worried about AI risk, that you can come up with these godlike AIs and you wouldn't be sure of their morality, right? And so before you gave them godlike powers, you'd have to be sure of their morality. So in the plan of salvation, we have the same kind of things. We have intelligences that we want to give godlike powers to. We want to make sure they can handle them. We want to make sure of their morality, right? And the problem is with AIs, and to a lesser extent with us, that if the game becomes obvious, right, then you've lost, then you're not testing their morality, you're testing their ability to follow the rules of the game, right? And so a certain distance is required to kind of make it seem like, to make it seem like, well, this world is kind of random and chaotic, and prayer doesn't always work, right? Because if you knew exactly that prayer always worked, then you'd have kind of an absolute faith, and you could behave in all the moral ways you did, but that would just mean you're Machiavellian, not moral, right? So does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. And you can hook up with me afterwards if you wanted to talk more about it. Yeah. Yes?
Well, my point of view on this is that if we were to take an iPhone to the Aborigines in Brazil.
Sure, yeah.
Would show it to them, and they'd take a picture of them, and then show them the picture, and they'd think it was the demon. And,
right.
And we think we're so vastly superior that, I mean, they are Aborigines. They've never seen anything like that. It's got to be magic.
Right.
Well, we have to think maybe we're the Aborigines, too.
Sure.
And these people, you know, coming from other places, obviously more talented than we are. And we're the Aborigines, and if they showed us an iPhone, we'd think it was a demon and so forth, or what their version of an iPhone
right,
is.
Yeah.
We are way, have way high expectations that, I mean, we think that we are magnificent because we've got roads and cars and Teslas and iPhones.
Right.
But I think we're still in kindergarten when it comes to understanding what this universe is all about. I mean, quantum theory has just got everybody completely buffaloed.
Right.
They use it, but they don't understand it enough to know what it really means.
Yeah.
Quantum theory is a religion for a lot of people.
Sure.
And we don't begin to understand that religion. It's magic for some people. So we are the Aborigines in the forest.
Right. Well, so 2 points. I mean, I remember reading Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond, and I mean, his argument was that the people in Papua New Guinea knew way more. I mean, in terms of the knowledge they had to have and the kind of the herb lore and all that stuff, were way ahead of us. And I mean, I think there is this issue that we're, you know, that our technology has almost become a crutch. It hasn't made us superior or more intelligent, right? And also, I think that in a general sense, it gets back to these preconceptions. I feel like humanity is in kind of this, you know, snotty teenager phase of its development, where it kind of feels like, man, we've figured all these things out, and we know all these things, and in reality, they're, you know, it's another Mark Twain quote, although I think this one might be apocryphal, where he said, "When I was 14, my old man was so ignorant, I could hardly stand to have him around. And when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much he'd learned in 7 years," right? And so I think it's the same kind of thing. So I think we got 5 more minutes, so we got time for more.
So speaking of iPhones.
Okay.
So Uchtdorf has compared the seer stone to an iPhone.
Yes.
I would guess you've probably had some thoughts related to this that kind of bleed into that magic worldview type, thinking about the seer stone. Is that kind of accurate or not so accurate? Have you started to think about that side of things?
Well, so
from this perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, the seer stone technology kind of angle, as you say, but I do think that that there are these parallels in technology, and sometimes we are uncomfortable with stretching that parallel too far, right? So we're comfortable with you know, communication via radio, but communication being some invisible thing instantaneously via prayer, we're not comfortable with. Like that when you look at science fiction writers and futurists in general, they're able to extract technology, but there's a certain point that they past which they can't get, right? And that, you know, comparisons like President Uchtdorf's are very useful in this endeavor, but that in the end, in some sense, it may convince us that we know more than we do, right? You know, we have a better handle on how things should work than we do. In reality, when you're talking about technology that could be a billion years ahead of us, we don't know. There's no predictions you could make, right? Does that answer your question?
I was just curious to see if you had used this to think about that same sort of a thing. Thanks.
Yeah, no problem. Anything else? Sure.
Of all worldviews in the world, I can't think of any worldview that would be more compatible with aliens of different levels of intelligence going around the universe than Mormonism. Here we propose that someday we're going to be developing intelligence. We're all going to have to learn, if Mormonism is true, and eternal progression, we're all going to have to become chemists and physicists. So why is it so far-fetched that beings are learning and some have technology higher than us, and maybe they're allowed occasionally to come here and teach ancient people how to build big structures? And it seems like to me our beliefs about beings in the future are more compatible than anybody else's.
Well, I think I would agree. I mean, that's part of the reason why I gave this presentation, is I think there are some futuristic ideas that dovetail really in an interesting way with Mormonism, which, of course, you know, the key big ideas were back in the 1830s. And like the one gentleman said, if Joseph Smith had turned his hand to writing science fiction, you know, who knows what would happen, right? So I think that there is, as I said, a lot of unfortunate preconceptions that keep people from imagining certain things could be a certain way. And as I said, that doesn't mean that they are that way, but I do think that there's kind of a myopic, you know, myopia in science and futurism that doesn't allow people to kind of truly explore all the potential possibilities. Anything else? Okay, I guess that's it.